you very much, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Bookbeat. You cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bull, the cinema, your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded with information that was never.
You are listening to listener-sponsored community radio, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, celebrating our 50th year of bringing you some of the best news, music, and talk on the planet. Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. Coming up next are some BBC headlines, station announcements, and then Madison Bookbeat. Stay tuned. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never be recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream.
Hello, we're the BBC World News. I'm Tom Dewsbury. President Trump has threatened to further escalate the US trade war with China, saying he'll impose an additional 50% tariff on Chinese goods unless Beijing scraps the retaliation plans. China's tariffs on US goods are due to come into force later this week. Here's our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
Under the new levies threatened by Donald Trump, Chinese goods shipped into the US would be taxed 104%. The U.S. president said on social media that all talks with China were canceled too, until Beijing dropped its own retaliatory tariffs. The effects of such high tariff rates would be mutually devastating. China and the U.S. are still economically dependent on reciprocal trade. Beijing has not yet responded.
Mr. Trump's comments came on a day of turmoil on stock markets around the world, fueled by the tariffs he imposed last week on almost every nation. Investors are concerned the measures could plunge the global economy into recession. The main European markets closed more than 4% down. Asian stocks suffered their biggest falls in decades. US markets have also tumbled and remain volatile as trading continues. Michelle Fleury's in New York.
Volatility is the watchword here on Wall Street. Traders very nervous. Meanwhile, we're starting to hear from some influential figures on Wall Street beginning to speak out against these tariffs. JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon saying it will push up inflation and slow growth. We've also heard from a Trump supporter and hedge fund manager saying that he wants the administration to consider a 90-day pause, warning that it would be terrible for the economy otherwise.
European trade ministers have broadly agreed to prioritise negotiations with the US over retaliation. At their meeting in Luxembourg, the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the EU stood ready to negotiate. Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Berlin.
Ursula von der Leyen says the offer of zero-for-zero tariffs was made to President Trump before his announcement of sweeping tariffs last week. But this didn't stop the US president from imposing 20% tariffs on goods imported from the European Union. Now the EU is preparing its response. European leaders were shaken last week, but now as US markets tumble and divisions appear among those advising President Trump, EU leaders seem to believe the best course is to sit tight and bide their time.
The heads of six United Nations agencies have appealed to world leaders to act urgently and decisively to reinstate a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and allow desperately needed food and medical supplies back in. Israel resumed its war 3 weeks ago and has blocked humanitarian supplies and fuel for 5 weeks as Hamas refused to extend the first phase of the ceasefire. I'm Tom Dewsbury with World News from the BBC. A French court has sentenced an Algerian Islamic State supporter to life in prison, finding him guilty of attempted murder over a bomb attack 6 years ago that wounded 13 people. 2 days before European elections, Mohamed Majoub placed a homemade bomb outside a bakery in Lyon. The younger brother of the Belgian king has lost a legal battle to claim social security benefits on top of his royal allowance. A court ruled Prince Laurent's claim, the first of its kind in Belgian history, unfounded. The 61-year-old insisted his work entitled him to the coverage granted to independent entrepreneurs and that he was acting out of principle rather than for money. Laurent received nearly $500,000 from state funds last year. Scientists say migrants experience a clear change in their gut bacteria when moving abroad, which could have negative effects on their health. Researchers from the Netherlands and Ghana compared the gut microbiome of Ghanaians in urban and rural areas at home to those who'd moved to Amsterdam. They found a loss or change in the diversity of gut bacteria could increase the risk of heart problems or conditions such as diabetes and obesity. Dr. Barbara Vahar is the study's lead author.
We found a very strong link between dietary intake and the microbiome. So we observed that rural Ghanaians ate a lot less fat and protein and salt, and it showed a very strong link with their microbiome composition. And we saw that there was a decrease in the diversity of the gut microbiomes in the Amsterdam Ghanaians.
One of Brazil's most popular ecotourism destinations has been partially closed after more than 30 attacks by biting fish this year. In the most serious incident, a tourist lost part of her finger as she swam in an artificial lake at the main resort in the town of Bonito in western Brazil. Tourists are still being allowed into the ecological park, but authorities have suspended all access to rivers and lakes. BBC News.
I'm MK Zariel, and I write very trans poetry, and as the internet's weird anarchist friend, I'd be honored to share some of it with you. Please join me on WORT's Access Hour, the night of April 7th, 7 to 8 p.m. Central, for some readings from my self-published zines and literary magazine collaborations. These poems will be interspersed with my musical inspirations, all songs by queer liberationist indie artists, and are perfect for anyone who loves anarchism, neuroqueer media, the bashback tendency, references to obscure gay liberationist texts, youth liberation, weird synesthetic imagery, all of the above, or none of the above, or everything. I can't wait to radicalize you. Thank you so much to Candy for Trees for creating the background music of this promo, and thanks to WORT for being awesome.
Hello, and welcome to Madison Bookbeat, your home for Madison authors and authors coming to town. I'm your host, Sarah Batke. Normally, I'm here every second Monday of the month, but due to a little scheduling change, I'm here on the first. I'm thrilled to have Brenda Cardenas as my guest today. Brenda was recently named by the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission as the State Wisconsin Poet Laureate. She's serving a three-year term from January 15, 2025 through December 31, 2027. Brenda Cardenas was born and raised in Milwaukee and has also lived in Beaver Dam, Appleton, Menasha, and Fond du Lac. She obtained her undergraduate degree at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and a Master's of Fine Arts degree in Creative Writing Poetry at the University of Michigan. She recently retired from a 35-year career teaching creative writing to students at every level, from seventh graders to doctoral candidates. From 2007 to 2024, she taught creative writing and U.S. Latino Latinx literatures at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. A former City of Milwaukee Poet Laureate, Cardenas has authored two full-length books, Trace from Red Hen Press and Boomerang from Bilingual Press. She has also authored or co-authored three chapbooks, Bread of the Earth / The Last Colors, A Quixote Seeds, and From the Tongues of Brick and Stone. The Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission, or WPLC, is an unincorporated organization formed to enrich the lives of Wisconsin's residents by sharing and encouraging poetry via the appointment of a Wisconsin Poet Laureate. WPLC is supported by individual donations and by financial support from the following member organizations: Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters, Wisconsin Center for the Book, Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets, Wisconsin Arts Board, Wisconsin Humanities Council, Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, Write On, Door County, Arts and Literature Laboratory of Madison, good friends of ours, Woodland Pattern Book Center, and the Wisconsin Book Festival. Brenda, thank you so much for joining us here during National Poetry Month, and congratulations on this wonderful honor.
Thank you so much, and I'm very happy to be here.
Wonderful.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. So maybe we can just start by hearing a little bit more about the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission and the work it does on behalf of poets and poetry in the state. So why is an organization like this so important right now?
Well, it's especially important because for a time, the state was funding the state poet laureateship. The government, the state government. And then that under the Scott Walker administration, they cut that funding. So that's when the Wisconsin Poet Laureate Commission, I think when they really came into being, maybe they were there before, I don't know for sure, but that was when they began to have board members from all these different representative organizations who now all contribute to funding the laureateship. And it isn't a lot of money. It's a very it's a very modest stipend that one gets every year, but that stipend allows us to, you know, fulfill our obligations, you know, especially the project that we have set out to do. The Poet Laureate does a number of different things. You know, you travel the state, you do a lot of poetry readings, as well as giving workshops and, you know, talks, all kinds of things like that. But you're also asked when you apply to propose a project. But that's one, you know, one reason that the commission exists, right? Mm-hmm. But they're also there to support the Poet Laureate in other ways, you know, by you know, answering any questions we may have, if we run into some kind of snag or snafu, you know, helping us figure out how to negotiate it, giving us their advice, you know, anything like that. You know, and there are some of the members of the board of directors of the commission are former state poet laureates themselves. So that's a real help for me, because I can go to them and, you know, ask them, oh, what should I do in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So they're sort of building community as well.
Exactly. And I mean, that's one of the purposes of the laureateship is, you know, to spread the good word of poetry, right? To help get people hooked on poetry, but also to make community among people out in our state who are not only people who are poets, but people who are readers as well. People who maybe they don't write, but they love reading and language, and, you know, so we pull them in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we'll talk about this a lot, I think, in our time together. But I often think poetry is sort of, it's kind of a nice gateway for a lot of people who are interested in writing, but maybe are a little afraid to try something long form, or, you know, just kind of want to play a little bit. And so it's really nice to hear that you're kind of doing a lot of outreach to reach those people who maybe wouldn't have as much exposure to poetry just in their daily life. So that's all really great. Maybe you can sort of recreate for us the moment when you first learned that you had been named the Poet Laureate.
Oh, my. I believe it was shortly after I interviewed. I must have been one of the last people that they interviewed, because I think it was later that same night that I got a call from the president or the, I think they're called the president of the commission, either the president or the director. I think it's the president, right, of the commission. And she told me that they had selected me. And I was just thrilled. You know, I just retired from that 35-year career teaching. And I thought when I retired that I would be like hanging around lying in a hammock and reading books all the time.
Yes.
But then I saw the calls for applications and I thought, this would be a great time to do this because it would have been very difficult for me to do it while I was teaching full time. Other poet laureates have, but I was the kind of professor that was very much a teacher's teacher. I was all in.
Yeah.
So I just don't know that I could have balanced it. And this is kind of the perfect time because I'm, you know, I'm still able to travel. I'm not, you know, I'm 63, but I'm not that old. But I can still, you know what I mean? I still have the energy to do it.
Yeah.
So I was very happy to hear that they had selected me.
Yeah, great. So what do you hope to accomplish then during your kind of 3-year tenure?
Well, I'm really excited about the project that I proposed. Right now I'm working with a web designer. We should probably have the website finished. Oh, it'll probably be up and running early in April.
Okay.
What I'm doing is I've written a lot of ekphrastic poems. That's not only what I write. I mean, I write all kinds of poems, but I've always had an interest. I have a huge love for visual art, an interest in visual art. And an ekphrastic poem is just a poem that is written, that's inspired by a work of visual art, or that is written in response to a work of visual art. And so At one point, I was invited to participate in a little project with printmakers where they asked the poets to write a poem about any piece of artwork in the world or responding to any piece of artwork in the world. And we did that. And then we turned them in and then they gave them to printmakers. And the printmakers made prints responding to our poems.
Wow.
Right? And then it was all in an exhibit. And I loved that project and I kept thinking, wouldn't it be great if it could keep going on and on, like a relay or like the old game of telephone?
Yeah.
So that's what my project does is because I'm a poet and I'm connected to more poets in the state than I am to visual artists, although I am making the visual art connections that I need as well, we'll start with poets. The poets and the visual artists who want to participate will sign up on the website to say, I want to participate. Okay. And they'll sign up under their region. And the regions we're using will have a map there on the website. So you can see, okay, I live in this town. It's considered this region, right? There's seven, we're making it 7 regions.
Okay.
And they'll sign up within their region. And then the first 10 in each region who sign up will write a poem based on, you know, any piece of visual art in the world, and then they will pass their poems on to the first 10 visual artists in their region that signed up.
Okay.
And those visual artists will create a piece of visual art inspired by the poem they received. Then they will take a picture of that piece of visual art and they will send it to another poet in their region.
Okay.
Who has agreed to participate, that poet will write a poem inspired by the piece of visual art, and then we'll send it on to a different visual artist.
Yeah.
Who you know, and we will, I'm sure that the relays will go longer, perhaps in some regions than in others. I mean, in highly populated regions, you're going to have more people, right?
Sure.
Just population-wise. But I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens, right, from that first poem that's put out there through all the different exchanges from poetry, visual artist. And then it will all be archived on that website.
Oh, great.
So all the poems will be published there and all of the photographs of the visual art will be there.
Yeah.
So that we, and hopefully as I near the end of my term, we'll have some kind of, I'm hoping to have some kind of a big event.
Yeah.
Where some of the poets are, you know, maybe we could even do it in a gallery somewhere where we can show some of the visual art pieces and have some of the poets there reading, right? Or if we can't do it in a place where we can hang the art, then perhaps we show pictures of it on a screen, right? But yeah, and so that's That's it in a nutshell. Now, yeah. I'm hoping it all works out. It's a big undertaking.
Yeah.
And I mean, the other part of it is that I'm going to be doing workshops in all of the different regions. I'll visit each region at least once, and many of them more than once, offering ekphrastic workshops. So I'm already have a bunch of those started, right, set up. So poets can come to the workshop and learn about writing an ekphrastic poem. You know, what have other poets done in the past as they've approached this mode, right? But one doesn't have to attend a workshop to participate, because all of the materials that I would use in the workshop are going to be on that website.
Yeah,
so
great.
There'll be, you know, an introduction that I give to this mode called ekphrasis. There'll be sample poems, sample ekphrastic poems and artworks. I have links to pages where it's the reverse, where it's an artist who's making art that's responding to a poem, right? All those materials will be available for people. So attending a workshop is not mandatory in order to participate.
Sure. Yeah.
And I want it to be, I say, when I use the terms poet and visual artist, that includes poets who've published their work, who've had books, visual artists who have exhibited, but it's not only those folks. I want this to be open to everybody. So you do not have to consider yourself a professional in order to participate. If you're a dabbler, if you consider yourself a dabbler, you know, well, I dabble in it a little bit. I try my hand at it. That's okay. You're welcome. We want you to participate. And different ages too. I'm hoping that it's all different ages, as diverse of a group as we can get in every way, shape, and form.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And I think, you know, that's something that a lot of our listeners would potentially, you know, be interested in or know people who might want to do something like that. So it's great to hear about it here. So I want to kind of shift a little bit and just talk about kind of bigger picture questions about, you know, poetry and how you kind of came to it. So I'd like to just kind of start with sort of the genesis question of when did you first begin writing?
Writing? I was probably about 8 years old.
Yeah.
And I would sit with a little blank book in the closet on top of my mother's shoes with a flashlight. And write these little whatever they were. I don't know what it was. I don't know what the genre was. Probably little stories, right? And I'd sit in there and I would write.
Yeah.
And I was hiding because of my brothers would have been like, "What are you doing? You know, get out here, play basketball. You know, get out here and shoot hoops. You know."
Yeah.
So I didn't want to be bothered or teased. So I'd be sitting in the bed. You know. I mean, I think even before that, when I was very little, an auntie who I was extremely close to was like a second mother to me. She would make little blank books for me.
Oh,
and she taught me how to write and how to draw. And she would say, you know, you write your stories in here.
Yeah.
So I think it goes, but in terms of poetry itself, I think my interest in poetry really took off or started when I was in high school. I took a class in American authors, and, you know, I mean, when I was in high school, we're talking the tail end of the 70s. So there wasn't much diversity in the books, but I fell in love with Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Brooks.
Yeah.
And I also fell in love with Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, as different as they are, right? And I still remember reading them and just being awestruck. And I also think that was a time when, and not to say it isn't now, but that was a time when music was very much about the lyrics. You know, we're coming out of the 60s, that whole folk music time, right?
Yeah.
Where the lyrics were really prevalent in the music. And many musicians at that time, they were really poets. You know, when you think of Leonard Cohen, or you think of Neil Young, or you think of Bob Dylan, or you know, they were writing poetry as their lyrics. And that was the music I was caught up in. You know, I had older cousins, they gave that music to me. And that was, so I think those were the things that inspired me at first to write.
Yeah.
Then I had a terrible little poem published in the high school newspaper. And so then I was off, you know. Then in undergrad school, I majored in English and concentrated in writing. And from there.
That's always, I think, really important to sort of hear those backstories, because oftentimes it is, you know, something that, you know, writers discover in a classroom or, you know, from a teacher or family member who's really involved and really, really interested in the arts and kind of, you know, supports you in your first sort of baby steps into writing. And I think...
You know what I just thought of? I had a teacher in fifth grade who would give us this time to just write in journals. They were like blue books or whatever, but she wanted us to write whatever, the summer vacation or whatever.
Yeah.
And everybody would moan and groan. And I would be, yes.
Yeah.
And I would just fill those pages. And then she was like ahead of her time. Because then she would call us up to the desk and she would have like these little mini conferences with us about what we wrote.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget her saying, Brenda, you should be a writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
The impact that can have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So can you remember the first poem that you wrote?
No, I don't know what the first poem would have been. It might have been that horrible little one in the high school.
Sure.
But it's long gone.
Right. So what do you like most about writing poetry?
So many things. Okay.
Yeah.
I love language. Mm. I love the rhythms and music of language. I love playing with language. I just like all of a sudden finding a phrase that kind of nails something and says it in a way it's never, or that I don't think it's been said before, right? Mm. It says it in a fresh way and yet in a way that communicates to others that particular feeling or moment or whatever it is that I'm trying to capture.
Yeah.
I feel like to some degree, I mean, there's so many different styles of poetry, but a lot of poets are really visual artists and musicians at the same time because we're painting with words. Mm. A lot of poems contain imagery, right? Yeah. So we're painting with words and we're also paying a lot of attention to the sounds, to the sonic values, the cadences, the rhythms, the alliteration, the, you know, assonance. And so those are things that I love about it. The other thing I love about poetry is the mystery in it. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times when something happens or I see something or I read something that makes me want to write a poem about X, you know, about something in particular. But there are a lot of times when I just start with language. I just start with a line and let the poem take me to where it wants to go. Let the poem develop that way out of language. And the surprises for me even are fantastic. And then, you know, I discover something more about myself right through that. And I discover something more about, you know, the world, right? And about others, because often, you know, I'm trying to figure out what is it that I'm doing here? What is it that I'm writing about? What is it that I'm trying to get at? And in thinking through that, I might start looking things up, you know, and doing research. Poets do research.
Right.
and then learning, right? So I'm always learning from it. And so, I mean, there's many other things too, but those are some of the things that I love the most. Poetry, because it's so concise, you know, as compared to you know, fiction, it's so concise. There's often a bit of mystery there, right? The reader is called upon to take an active role in making the meaning, right? In figuring out for themselves what the poem is trying to express.
Yeah.
You know, and that can be different for a lot of different readers, which is fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I mean, that allows a little bit of mystery for the readers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do you find to be the most challenging about poetry?
There are so many incredible, amazing poets out there that sometimes when I read, I'm like, why should I ever write another word again?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even begin to approach what this person is doing.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm in the process right now of, I'm one of a panel of three judges judging a huge poetry book contest.
Mm.
So I've been reading my brains out.
Yeah.
And I'm reading these books and I'm like, oh my God. You know, like, so, I mean, so many of these books could be winners. And I'm just floored by how beautifully, you know, others write. Mm. So that's always a challenge. I think a lot of us feel that way. A lot of poets feel that way,
yeah.
And writers that, I mean, our reading is always ahead of our writing. So the things that I'm reading that I'm falling in love with are doing something I can't quite do, or I'm not doing yet. You know, I'm not there yet. And maybe I never want to actually write like that person, because it would be false. I might love what they're doing, but it would be false for me to try to do that. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You can only do your own thing. But I think that's one of the things that's challenging.
Sure.
For me in particular, one challenge is to pare down. I always overwrite, and then I take away, I strip away.
Sure. Yeah.
I think another challenge is leaving some of the strangeness and weird turns alone and not feeling like I need to worry about editing them to make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? Because sometimes those are the best aspects of the poem, right?
Yeah.
But there's also this, maybe it's the teacher in me, there's this, oh, I got to be clear though. Is this clear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you want a certain amount of clarity, but you also want that mystery, like I said, and those that strangeness sometimes. And so not over editing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think those are a couple of the challenges.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I face.
Yeah. You kind of touched on this a little bit already, but what do you enjoy most about poetry just as a reader?
Oh, some of the same things that I just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appreciate many different kinds and styles of poetry.
Mm.
I mean, when one teaches that, especially at an advanced level, like a graduate level, one has to learn to read and appreciate all different types of poetry if you're going to be a good mentor, because you don't want to make that poet into you.
Right.
You want that poet to be the best poet they can be with what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I appreciate many different kinds of poetry. But what am I most drawn to? What gets me excited? A poem I learn something from, or a book of poetry that I learn from, that maybe I knew nothing about this, you know, what the book is exploring, or I knew little about it. I really appreciate a kind of lyrical poem, a lyricism. Like, I want to hear the music and the language.
Mm, yeah,
you know, but and sometimes that comes through a lyrical bent to the writing, but sometimes it comes through voice. That the voice will just be so strong in the poem that you think, wow, this person could also write fiction, because they could write a character that, and that character's voice would be so distinct from anybody else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sometimes it's that presence of voice that's just so strong that it's kind of like, well, now that I've read this book by this person, anything else I pick up, I would know it was them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
unless they completely changed the voice.
Yeah.
Right.
So, right.
I think those are things that I look for. Fresh language, fresh turns of phrase, a new way of dating something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I'm just floored by what a poet does with the sentence, you know, with syntax, you know, with how they bend the syntax or with how they play the line off the sentence, right? So line breaks that are particularly meaningful. You know, some people just break on rhythm and that's fine, but there are, you know, a master of the line break is breaking, you know this, is breaking right after a certain word because they're getting one meaning at the end of that line from that word, and they're getting a whole nother meaning when you move your eyes down to the next line, right? So there's all these kind of, and those are very intricate little, you know, you know, right? But those are things that draw me. I want something also that makes me feel. So I don't mean emotional drivel all over the place. That's not what I mean. Actually, oftentimes a poem that holds back more, that pulls back, that is more understated, will coax more emotion in the reader, right? The reader will actually respond more emotionally to that writer who understated it than to the one who overstates it, right? So I have a great appreciation for real experimental poetry as well. But my husband always says to me, you like a warm experimentalism. You appreciate like what they're doing, the kind of tectonics or what's a better word, gymnastics that they're doing with language. You appreciate that, or you appreciate the leaps they're taking, but you want to feel something. So you like a kind of warmth to that. I don't want just this kind of geometric.
Yes, right. Yeah.
Although there's a place for that.
Sure. You know? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's often a very intellectual poem.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's what's great. There's room for all of those kinds of things in the genre. And I think that's a good place to kind of go into your latest book, Trace. And I would love if you could read a poem to us from that book.
Okay. I'm going to read you one, since I talked all about my project and Ekphrastis. I'll read you an Ekphrastis poem.
Yeah, great.
So this poem was written or inspired by three drawings by an artist named Eric Ricardo de Luna Genel, an artist in Mexico who does these black and white line drawings. And he has huge numbers of them, and he calls the series Cien Nombres para la Muerte, or 100 Names for Death. And each one is a skeleton, but she's always dressed a different way and doing different things, okay? You don't have to see them to understand the poem, okay? So this is Cien Nombres para la Muerte, las jodidas, the screwed ones. We are bent from the loads we've carried, strapped to our bony backs, sacks of maíz, hierbas, frijoles, bundles of firewood, jerry jugs of precious agua. Each Saturday, we haul tall stacks of caged birds to the mercado to sell their captive songs, their laments our heaviest burden. Hobble a mile in our ragged huaraches, holes in their tire tread soles. Follow us to the village of whispers where the only gritos belong to the wind, empty doorways grown over with weeds, our men's dusty boots waiting years for their return. Look into the cenotes of our eyes. You'll find no fish, no flores, no monedas. Only sacrifices with their mouths full of mud and the dread of our itchy grins. Then tell us you would never risk wrapping your little lamb in a rebozo, grabbing your withered staff and heading north, devil sun, scorpion, migra be damned. You'd fly for the birds whose latches you could not unlock. You'd fly so the only satchel your daughter hoists on her shoulders is heavy with libros, lápices, y sueños. You'd fly, never believing they would wrest her from your back and lock her in a cage.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think you can feel in that a lot of what you were talking about earlier, just not just the sense of mystery, but there's a lot of, there's like a tactile feel to the writing there and, you know, attention to language and how it sounds and how it flows. And I guess I want to start by asking, you know, what connections this book sort of has to your work overall, and if there are sort of themes and forms that you find yourself returning to a lot in your work.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I think connects over through all my work, both in my first book and chapbooks and, you know, stuff that's not in a book yet, is that I, you know, I don't, I mean, as you can see, you read these books. It's only in some poems. It's not in every poem in the book, but that I do tend to mix Spanish and English. Mm-hmm. So there are poems written in Inglañol or Spanglish or whatever you want to call it. That one had a little bit of Spanish, but sometimes there's a lot more Spanish and it really moves back and forth between the languages. And that's because I grew up hearing both languages, you know, both languages are a part of me. Mm-hmm. And but it's also because I can get interlingual rhymes and interlingual, sure. And, you know, alliterations and all of that doing that. Right. So, yeah. It's from a craft perspective as well as a, you know, heritage. So that's one thing that I think carries through my work. There'll always be some poems in a book where where that happens. Mm-hmm. I also think that I've kind of forever been obsessed with the kind of, it's very general, the kind of liminal spaces or in-between spaces. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I think that's because I'm you know, a product of multiple cultures. And so I've always felt betwixt and between them, right? A one shoe in each world, or however you want to put it. And so I'm drawn then to, and I don't see that as a bad thing, because I think that out of those spaces can come incredible creativity. Mm-hmm. So when you think of like borderlands, whether we're talking about the actual physical borderland or whether we're talking about more theoretical borderlands, right? Mm-hmm. I think are spaces that there are spaces where there's a lot of hybrid things that happen, right? These hybrids that become something wholly new, right? Mm-hmm. And then they're hybrid or syncretic spaces. They're also spaces that allow for something to flourish in the gap. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense or being too abstract, but I think that is, you'll see that theme come back over and over again in my work. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of why I called this book Trace, because I was thinking about the traces that we leave behind, you know, not only when we die, but just as we move through this world. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it from a, there, I'm also very concerned with the environment and ecology, and a number of poems in this book and in the other one also speak to those concerns. But so also like they talk about tread lightly upon the earth, mm-hmm. right? What are the traces that we're leaving, and what can be done with those traces, and how might they affect others who come upon them, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And I think I was also thinking about, because I write ekphrastic poems about all different kinds of visual art, but I am especially drawn to earthworks, so installations that are made in the environment, mm-hmm. that where the artists use materials from the land, but they don't hurt the land. They'll use those materials and they will create the art piece right there. And then over time, the art piece will just dissolve. Mm-hmm. It will just go back, you know, become the earth again.
Yeah.
Sometimes they take it down, but if they, you know, they're asked to take it down, but if they didn't, that's what would happen. Mm-hmm. So there are poems responding to the artist Ana Mendieta, whose work I just love. And she did, you know, she photographed herself. It was either herself or in the environment. Like, for example, she's got a piece called Tree of Life where she puts herself up against a tree and covers her body with all of this mud. And it looks like she's part of the tree, like she's growing out of the tree, you know? There are other pieces where she just traced in the land. So like maybe in the sand, she traced a figure. They're often a very kind of feminine figure. And then she put like flower buds and rocks or stones or whatever in it. And she made, and then eventually the tide will wash it away. So I'm kind of obsessed with the ephemeral. And so that was another reason for trace, because Ana Mendieta was always leaving these traces in the land. And another artist, a Milwaukee artist whose work I love, who does that, his name is Roy Stapp. And so there's poems in here responding to his work as well. But I mean, I also like to write. I also am inspired by paintings and sculptures and things like that. But I think these concepts of the ephemeral, the in-between, the hybrid, I think that comes back over and over again in my work. Culture as well. I think, you know, I write about my culture, but not only. So there are poems in here that don't have, you know, you wouldn't know what the ethnic background of the poet was at all, you know, because we should all be able to write about anything. There are definitely poems that reference my Mexican-American heritage.
I love the idea of sort of responding to something ephemeral, as you were saying, with words, which, you know, I suppose we sort of like to think of as a permanent, but, you know, it's not always the case. But I love that. I was wondering, like, talking about ekphrasis and sort of visual works, how do you find these pieces, and, you know, what you know, makes you say, yes, I want to respond to that?
I go to art museums and galleries a lot. I love visual art. So I'll see something that, you know, that there's a exhibit of this or that, and I go. And then if something really grabs me, I'll go home and I'll do more research on the artist, and I'll start finding other pieces. And then I'm buying art books. So I have a whole collection of art books, right? So, I mean, that's often how it happens. Like when I do these workshops in places, I have a huge collection of art on postcards. Hundreds and hundreds. And so I'll take those with me. And they have, and the people there will have a lot of choices because I have so many. And so hopefully they'll find something that Or if it's in a gallery, if it's during a certain exhibit, well, then they'll have to pick from what's there. But people usually find something that intrigues them. I mean, and it doesn't have to be, you don't have to love the work. Maybe you want to argue with it. Your poem. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah, it doesn't always have to be, you know, admiration that you're expressing. You know?
Yeah, that's true. So one thing I wanted to talk a little bit about with some of the poems in this work, that something I noticed is how they're kind of literally set out on the page. You know, because we often think about poetry as sort of, you know, it's a medium where, you know, we think about it as being designed to be read aloud. But, you know, obviously that's important, but there's a visual, and sometimes even you can think of it as like a physical component to it as well, and like how you're using the space that you have. So I would love to just hear you talk a little bit about that, and sort of how you think about like how a poem looks and how you put it together.
For me, form follows content. And I think for any writer, right, there's with poetry that we always talk about that marriage of content and form. And so sometimes, this can have to do with how it's set on the page. It can also have to do with whether it's written in couplets or quatrains or tercets or one big fat stanza, right? Oftentimes it will be something in the content of the poem, So it might be, I'm just going to give you very simplistic examples, but so maybe a poem is written about a relationship between two people, a mother and a child, two lovers, whatever. Well, you know, it would make sense to write that in couplets, right? Because of the notion of the two, right?
Yeah.
It might be if you're writing about something, let's say in nature, that sways, you know, like a tide goes in and out. In a body of water, a lake or an ocean. And so you might have the line staggered because you're kind of simulating that, right? In some of my poems, like there's another Ana Mendieta poem, another poem, or I didn't read one of those, but there's a poem responding to her work where the first half of it is just set up with those lines kind of going in and out. But then the second half of the poem has just these words scattered. And they're scattered on the page. Yeah. And that's because the second half of the poem is an erasure of the first half of the poem.
Yeah.
Where I've only left particular words from the first half. And they're scattered because I've left them where they would have been in the sentence. And the reason I did that all to begin with is because it's about a piece that she carved into a hillside that with wind and rain and erosion will disappear. So by doing the erasure, the second half of the poem being an erasure of the first, I'm trying to get after her kind of art, the ephemerality in the art, right? And so that's why in that case, I mean, there's not always a strict correlation. Sometimes it's like just a feeling that you have, like just a sense of this I want to slow the reader down in this poem. I need there to be pauses. I need there to be longer pauses and gaps to let them kind of take it in and breathe. So I'm going to put it on the page in a way where I have these kind of bigger spaces or caesuras between some of the words. And the words are more, you know, they're not all lined up at the left-hand margin. Too often we think we have to be like handcuffed to the left-hand margin. And nobody ever said that, you know. That's what's wonderful about poetry. There's a kind of, like you said, there's this visual. And sometimes the way it's laid out on the page, I think adds part of the meaning. You get part of the meaning. If you go back to like visual poetry, not back to, because people are still creating it, but I think of the big heyday of it in the 50s and 60s with the Brazilians and the Canadians, you know, the whole poem falls apart if you take away the way it's laid out on the page, because it's conceptual. And the way it's laid out on the page is giving it its whole meaning. So those are some of the things.
So what's next for you aside from obviously serving as poet laureate? Are you working on a new book?
Yeah, I'm working on poems. I mean, I probably have enough poems or almost enough poems right now for another book, but I don't know that they all go together. You know what I mean? As a book, right? I'm at that place right now where I'm continuing to write. But I really need to take all this stuff I've written and print it out, put it all out on a floor, start looking at it and saying, you know, okay, this would work, this would work. But where are the gaps or what do I want to write into? Or, you know what I mean? Like, So it might be at least another year, I would say. With the laureateship, it might be 2 years, right? before I'm ready to have a manuscript all done and sent. It'd be great if I could do that within a year, but we'll see. But I'm continuing to write, and I write with a women's writing group on Zoom every single Friday morning. And it's a generative group. It's not, we don't critique. It's all about creating. And so I get lots of drafts from that. And even if my week gets crazy busy, I do that the way some people jog. You know, like they say, I put that first no matter what.
I wish
I could do that with jogging, but there is no way. Right? But I do that with my Friday morning writing group.
Yeah. No, that's great. It's good to have those things because sometimes it can just get lost in the shuffle of everything else. So No, I think that's great. Well, we'll look forward to it whenever it's ready. Maybe we could just end with having you read another poem for us.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I'm going to read this one called Brother. This is, my youngest brother died of heart failure. There's nothing like, it's just the wrong order of things, you know? Mm-hmm. Your youngest brother is not supposed to die before you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was a very hard time in my life, but this is coming out of that experience. Mm-hmm. It's called Brother, beginning with a line by Robin Riegler. My pain is a cloud that might be saying goodbye. It waves its plump little hand and sails into blue. I imagine a fist pump and wink, mischievous smirk to rival your Cheshire grin. It took a year before I began to wake without memory of missing your last words, because by the time I arrived, they had all flown north in search of a cool lake breeze rustling between aspens, the loon's Yorona whale ghosting midnight's misty waves, knotty pine walls of the tiny room where we slept three to a bed, comforted by dim yellow light shining through cracks and by sounds of our parents, grandparents, drinking beer and slapping cards down on the oilcloth just outside the drawn curtain we pretended was a door.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with poet Brenda Cardenas, who was recently named the Wisconsin Poet Laureate. She will be serving her term from January 15th, 2025 through December 31st, 2027. Her most recent full-length book is Trace, which is available from Red Hen Press. Brenda, I imagine you have quite a few events that you are coming up. So maybe if you want to plug a few that listeners might be able to go to, that would be great.
I would be happy to. So, so let's stick to Wisconsin. On April 12th and 13th, April 12th, I'm giving a workshop at Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee. And it's not an ekphrastic workshop. It's actually a workshop called The Places We Call Home. And we'll be writing poems regarding home, but not the house you live in, different ideas of what is home. You know, home can be a person. Home can be a river, right? So that's one. And then we'll be using example poems from a new anthology called The Library of America Latino Poetry Anthology. And then the next day at Woodland Pattern, there will be a panel. I will be on it, as well as poets Mauricio Kilwen Guevara, Francisco Aragon, Reina León, and Roberto Harrison. And then the scholar, Michael Dowdy, who's a scholar of Latino, Latine literature. He will be coming, and we'll have a panel where we'll each do a little reading. And then Michael Dowdy will be asking the panel questions, and we'll be talking about this new book and about the state of Latino literature in general. And then on April 24th, the Lake Literary Center in Fond du Lac, I'll be giving an ekphrastic poetry workshop. And on that's the 24th in the afternoon. And the 24th in the evening, I'll be giving a reading in Fond du Lac at the Thelma Center for the Arts.
Great.
Okay, great.
Wonderful. So there's a few options for listeners who are interested in doing some work of their own along with Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
So you've been listening to Madison Bookbeat. I'm your host, Sarah Batke. Thank you to Andrew Thomas for running the soundboard today, to news director Sholly Pittman, to you for listening, and of course to Brenda for being here today. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Coming up next is a 3-hour set of All Around Jazz with Alex Wilding White, but first, some announcements. Thank you.
Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. Emmy-nominated trumpeter and singer Benny Banach III has proven to be that rarest of talents. Not only a fiery trumpet player with a stirring command of the post-bop trumpet vernacular, but also a singer with a sly, mature, naturally expressive delivery in the post-Sinatra mold. Third in a generational line of Pittsburgh jazz notables, Benny follows in the footsteps of his trumpeter and bandleader grandfather, Benny Banach Sr., and his father, Benny Banach Jr., who gave the young Benny his first professional experience. Benny's group includes Tyler Henderson on piano, Caleb Tabachman on bass, and Joe Perry on drums. More information at cafecoda.club. Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. You are listening to WORT Madison. Make Music Madison is back on June 21st for the 13th annual day of free outdoor live music across the city. Here's how you can get involved. Online registration for musicians to participate and venues to schedule events is open through June 1st at makemusicmadison.org. All genres and styles of music are welcome, and there are no age limits or skill levels required. The Make Music Madison website is used to match artists who need a stage with venues who seek performers. At noon on June 20th, matchmaking ends and all shows must be confirmed in the system. Again, advance registration for venues and musicians at makemusicmadison.org closes at 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, June 1st. And mark your calendars for Make Music Day on Saturday, June 21st. Bringing you a variety of music every day of the year, this is WORT Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, April 7th.
America's family farmers were astonished.